From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Director John Frankenheimer's 1962 film, The Manchurian Candidate, reflected American fears during the height of the Cold War. Frankenheimer's new film, The Fourth War, is about two military officers, one Soviet, one American, who keep fighting the Cold War even though it's over. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Frankenheimer about his movies. Also, Lester Brown of the World Watch Institute outlines the steps he thinks we'll need to take over the next 40 years to save the environment. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a series of performances by conductor Otto Klemperer. And book critic John Leonard reviews Philip Roth's new novel, Deception. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Leaders of the coup in South Africa's nominally independent homeland of Ciskei today asked Nelson Mandela's African National Congress to help them police the territory after 2 days of violence. NPR's John Madison reports.
Those responsible for the coup arrested the son of President for Life, Lennox Sebe, and several others. After that, they faced no resistance. On the contrary, the Sebe regime seemed to be so unpopular that the celebrations soon were out of hand and all facilities linked with the Sebe name became targets. The result was a death toll of at least 20, 500 injuries and millions of dollars of damage to factories, buses and businesses. Today, coup leader Brigadier Josh Toza told a news conference, "When we took over, we didn't expect the jubilation to turn into turmoil." To end that turmoil, Toza asked the South African military for help. At his request, the ANC also organized busloads of its supporters to go and stop the looters. A group of looters were brought to a public rally and exposed for their actions as part of an effort to end the violence. I'm John Madison in Johannesburg.
American Jews are working to raise $420 million this year to help settle a flood of Soviet Jewish immigrants in Israel. Fundraisers for the United Jewish Appeal said the money will be used to transport immigrants from the Soviet Union, to refurbish absorption centers in Israel, and to help with the costs of resettlement. Israel has imposed censorship on news about Soviet Jewish immigration after Arab countries claim the immigration policy is a plot to settle the new arrivals in the occupied territories. A group of corporate leaders announced on Capitol Hill today that they've raised $77 million for a low-income housing program that will create 2,000 units of low-income housing. Carol Ann Clark has more.
The corporation's money will go into a fund created by the Local Initiative Support Corporation, a nonprofit group which uses the funds to construct and rehabilitate low-income housing. The program's linchpin is the low-income tax credit, offering corporations a tax break in return for their investment. The tax credit, though, expires at the end of the year, and the Bush administration says it can support only a one-year extension. Paul Grogan, the president of the Support Corporation, says no one seems to have trouble finding money for housing subsidies used by the middle and upper class.
The annual total of the mortgage interest deduction and the local real estate tax deduction that all of us homeowners can take is somewhere in the vicinity of $50 billion a year. Well, here's a program that's reaching the real poor, and it's $300 million a year.
A bill to make the tax credit permanent has drawn bipartisan support. For National Public Radio, I'm Carol Ann Clark in Washington.
On Wall Street today, stocks were up across the board. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 27.25 points to close at 2,676.8. This is NPR. White House Press Secretary Marlon Fitzwater said today that the Pentagon is investigating charges that American soldiers returning from the U.S. invasion of Panama may be smuggling drugs. Fitzwater was responding to a report yesterday by CBS News. That story said alleged narcotic smuggling by homecoming soldiers could be linked to Friday's bombing of a Panamanian nightclub in which an American soldier was killed. The Pentagon said an investigation into drug trafficking in Panama is underway, but said that no American soldiers have been arrested or charged with a crime. The attorney for an FBI agent currently on suspension in Miami said today that the FBI is trying to retaliate against the agent for his testimony in a 1988 discrimination suit against the Bureau. Jeff White has more on the story.
Attorney Hugo Rodriguez accused the FBI of leaking a story that his client was being investigated for alleged links with Cuban spies. Rodriguez said agent Fernando Mata used to be an FBI counterintelligence specialist, but that he was never a spy. Rodriguez claimed the agency is illegally using the criminal justice system to investigate its own employees.
We have found during our litigation that they investigate family members for their sexual activities, their drinking propensities, and their drug propensities. And what I'm telling you is that I don't find anything unusual. And if they do it to their own, what the hell do you think they may be doing to you and I?
Rodriguez said at least 10 agents throughout the country have been receiving the same type of treatment as Mata, and that charges will be filed against the FBI shortly. For National Public Radio, I'm Jeff White in Miami.
The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists has reset its doomsday clock to reflect the easing of world tensions. The doomsday clock's a symbol used on the scientific journal to reflect the probability of nuclear war. Midnight on the clock represents a nuclear holocaust. Today, the directors of the journal announced the clock's been set back 4 minutes to 10 minutes before midnight. I'm Corey Flintoff, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Film director John Frankenheimer has directed a new glasnost thriller called The Fourth War. Frankenheimer is known for his political thrillers, including The Train, 7 Days in May, and The Manchurian Candidate. Frankenheimer first made a name for himself in his 30s, directing live TV drama. He directed the series Playhouse 90 for 6 years in the mid-1950s. One of his shows was the highly acclaimed drama The Days of Wine and Roses. During his first years in film in the late 50s and early 60s, he became the favored director of Burt Lancaster, directing him in 5 films, including The Birdman of Alcatraz. Frankenheimer's other movies include French Connection 2, The Fixer, Black Sunday, and 52 Pickup. Frankenheimer describes his new film, The Fourth War, as being about dinosaurs of the Cold War.
The movie has as its basic premise a story of two men, two warriors really, two highly decorated military heroes who find themselves in a time of glasnost where there's no war to fight. They've been trained all their lives that the other is the enemy. And suddenly there is no enemy. There is no war. And they don't know, I mean, this is a very, very real problem, a very serious problem in this time that we find ourselves today, in peace, in relative peace, in glasnost, in a time of détente. What do you do with these men that you've trained all their lives to be the military heroes, to be the Audie Murphys, to be the war heroes? And what do you do with them now that there is no war? And that's the problem that this picture poses. I don't think we give an answer, but that's what we pose.
Well, the movie was made a few months before the recent events in Eastern Europe, like the opening of the wall in Germany. When you were probably watching on TV the opening of the wall, what were you thinking about in terms of the film? How did you think that was going to affect the timeliness of your movie?
My feeling was, thank God we made this movie. We had anticipated all that stuff happening, not quite to the dramatic way that it did, but we certainly talk about the changes that are happening and the fact that things are not any longer what they are, and our character is unable to change. Both of our characters are unable to change, and that's their flaw. And that's what makes the movie possible.
You've done several films about the military, 7 Days in May, The Manchurian Candidate. You went to military school as a child, right?
Yes, it's true.
Did you feel like that gave you insights into the military mind at all?
Yes, I do. And I also was a lieutenant in the Air Force, and I was General LeMay's personal photographer during the Korean War and things like that. And yes, I do. I feel that it's given me a tremendous insight into the military mind, especially on higher levels, because I was around general officers a lot. And it's helped me.
When you were General LeMay's personal photographer during the Korean War, what did that entail?
Well, it entailed photographing the general quite a bit. It entailed,
right.
It entailed also doing some training films. I was in the Air Photographic Squadron that did a lot of training films in the United States. That's how I started, actually.
Started making movies.
Yeah.
Well, did you prefer making documentary films for the military to fighting?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm not a fool. I mean, I'm not crazy. Yeah, I loved it.
John Frankenheimer is my guest, and his movies include The Manchurian Candidate, French Connection 2, 52 Pickup, Black Sunday, and the new film, The Fourth War, which stars Roy Scheider and Harry Dean Stanton and is scheduled to open on March 23rd. I want to ask you a little bit about The Manchurian Candidate, which I think is just a really extraordinary movie. You were the co-producer of the movie. I assume that means that you were one of the people who were behind making it, as opposed to a director who was brought on after the idea.
Yes,
was already in
yes.
effect.
In this particular case, George Axelrod and I bought the book. We developed it, and then I ended up directing it, of course.
How did Sinatra get involved with the movie?
Well, Sinatra was the whole element that made the movie possible. The movie had been turned down by every studio in town. And when George Axelrod and I bought the book, we bought it by buying the book in a bookstore. It had been optioned and reoptioned and dropped and never been able to be made. And we knew that Frank Sinatra had read the book and Frank Sinatra was interested in the picture, but he had never really gone the whole nine yards and optioned it. So we optioned it, and without a script, Frank Sinatra committed to it. And, of course, right away as soon as he committed to it, we had the necessary financing to make the movie.
Did you have any idea he'd be as good as he was in it? I mean, did you have as much faith in his acting abilities when you started?
No. I didn't want to make the movie with Frank Sinatra. I was scared of it. I had heard he was very difficult. I had heard that he treated directors badly, all those things. I expressed these reservations to George Axelrod, and he said, I'm going to make the movie with Frank Sinatra, whether you do it or whether you don't. He said, I'll buy you out, but I want to make this movie with Sinatra. Sinatra's going to get this picture made. And if you have problems with Sinatra, he said, I would suggest that you discuss them with him instead of discussing them with me. And I made an appointment to see Mr. Sinatra. I went up to see him at his house, and I expressed my reservations to him. And he said, look, I guarantee you, whether what you've heard is true, whether what you've heard is not true, there is my side to all that, too. He said, I want to do this picture, I want to work with you, and I feel that we're going to get along just fine. And that was the last discussion we ever had. We got along absolutely fabulously. I loved working with Frank Sinatra. It was a joy making that picture. It was one of the happiest experiences in my life making that picture, and I loved everything that Sinatra did. I mean, he was just a joy to work with, and we've been close friends ever since.
There's a scene I have to ask you about. It's really an extraordinary scene. This is the garden club dream scene. Frank Sinatra is having these recurring nightmares in which he's with all of the men from his army troop from the Korean War. He's with them at a ladies' garden club, and suddenly the ladies' garden club turns into a lot of Korean soldiers, and the head Korean soldier is discussing how he's brainwashing these soldiers into believing that they're at a garden party. And then to show how brainwashed they really are, he has Lawrence Harvey just walk over and strangle to death one of the men. You shot that scene in such a disorienting way. The camera just kind of revolves around all the women of the garden club first, and then suddenly the women are transformed into men, and you're as confused as Frank Sinatra is by all of this. Tell me about how you decided to shoot this scene.
Well, number one, the idea of the scene came right out of Richard Condon's book. He described pretty well what the scene should look like. So it was up to me to interpret it. And the shot that you're talking about is a 360-degree shot, which starts on the stage of a hotel in New Jersey where a woman is talking about hydrangeas, and we pan around the room, and you think that it's just women listening to this, a garden club. And then as the camera completes its 360-degree arc, you suddenly find yourself on a stage in an amphitheater in Korea, and the Chinese psychiatrist is talking about brainwashing. So what we did was we designed a set that could be moved, and it took a little athletic ability from the actors to run from one platform to the other while we were back on the garden club. And the two platforms were on a kind of a railroad track, and we slid one right in place as the camera moved off the first one. But what it did was it set in the audience's mind that this was not just the magic in the movies, that something very strange here was happening, because we never cut. And the audience realizes when you cut. They might not know what it is, but they know that there's been some mechanical device put between them and the story. And I wanted to do it all in one shot. And I think after we accomplished that shot, then we were able to cut to anything that we wanted to do. And we filmed that sequence with about seven or eight different combinations. The women in Korea, the Chinese Manchurian delegates in New Jersey, the actors on the New Jersey stage, hotel, the actors in the Korean amphitheater. And we were able to intercut it at will back and forth. And after the first shot, the suspension of disbelief with the audience was complete. So we were able to kind of manipulate them back and forth whenever we wanted to. And you're right, we did cut it in such a way that it was confusing, and deliberately so.
Now, one of the black men from this same troupe that Sinatra was in has the same dream. But when he has the dream, all of the women from the ladies' club are black. Was that in the novel, or is that your invention, to have the two people have their own version of this same dream?
That was me. What I never did do, I mean, I had it done, but I just didn't dare take the shot of it. In the back of the room, we had a white bellboy. But we never did show it. If you look carefully, you can see it.
That's great. It's a wonderful... It's wonderful the way you contrast the two dreams.
You know, I want to tell you one other thing about that movie. That's something that I don't think people are aware of, but I think it's important to say in these days and times, which is that that was one of the first movies where the producer and director used a black actor to play a part that was not written for a black.
Uh-huh.
Today it's done quite often, but that was very new at the time, to take the black actor, cast him as the psychiatrist, and that part was not written for a black actor. I've since done it quite a bit, but I just wanted to bring that up.
John Frankenheimer is my guest. The movie was released in 1962. This was just before the Kennedy assassination. Manchurian Candidate was out of circulation for 26 years. It was re-released in 1987. I know Frank Sinatra was a friend of Kennedy. Is that why the movie was out of circulation for so long?
No,
It had nothing to do with the assassination?
No.
What is the story?
The story is basically one of greed, of money, as most American stories are. The movie was out of circulation for the simple reason that United Artists carried the movie through a complicated process of Chinese bookkeeping, totally in the red for years and years and years. They had it cross-collateralized with every other movie that Frank Sinatra had made for United Artists. And we were so far in the red that if we had been E.T. and re-released, we would have been in the red. And when this movie finished its run, which was before the president's assassination, there were no ancillary markets as you know them today. There was no tape. There was no cable. There just wasn't anything like that. And what there was network television and then syndicated television. Then you went into the archives, which all these movies did. And in fact, Manchurian Candidate did play on network television one time around. However, what they failed to realize was that in 1970, the rights reverted to Frank Sinatra, the rights for re-release. They had just thrown this in as a bone in his contract to get him to agree to other things. And it was the best thing in the world for us, because what happened was that a market was developed for the movie. I mean, the press loved the movie. The media loved the movie. And the more people talked about the movie, the less it became possible to see it. And what happened was, finally, there was a management in place at United Artists for 25 minutes or long enough for us to negotiate a deal with them so that we could start out from scratch, and we were neither in the red nor in the black, to re-release the movie, and that's what we did. And it turned out very nicely for all of us.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a break, and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is film director John Frankenheimer. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
John Frankenheimer is my guest. He directed the films The Manchurian Candidate, French Connection 2, Birdman of Alcatraz, 52 Pickup, and Black Sunday. His new film is called The Fourth War, and it stars Roy Scheider, Harry Dean Stanton, and Jürgen
Prochnow.
Thank you.
It's okay. And you might also add that Jürgen is the actor who was in that wonderful German movie Das Boot. He played the submarine captain in that.
He was also very good in Dry White Season.
He was, wasn't he?
Yes, yeah, he really was.
Yeah.
You were good friends with Bobby Kennedy, and I believe you were with him the night that he was assassinated.
Yes, I was.
And he was supposed to go to your house afterwards. I think you were working with him on campaign ads.
You're absolutely right. Yeah, he was staying at my house, actually, and I drove him to the Ambassador Hotel, and I had done his film and television during his campaign, yes.
What effect did it have on you when he was assassinated?
Terrible. Really, honest to God, Terry, terrible. I had, in layman's terms, a nervous breakdown. I moved to Europe. I stayed in Europe for 7 years after that. It just was really, it was a terrible traumatic effect on me.
Was it because, I mean, I guess I understand why, but was it because you were that close or because of the suddenness and because of the assassination?
All of it.
Yeah.
I was close to him. I honestly believed, and I had let myself be totally convinced that this man would have been a superb president of the United States, and I honestly believe that to this day. And to see that all shattered in that one horrible moment was just more than I could accept.
I
had a very bad time after it.
So you left the States for a while?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I know it was because of that. I let it be. I kind of made believe it was for other reasons, but that was basically what the reason was.
And how did that affect your movie career? I mean, you weren't here making movies for several years.
No, but I made movies in Europe, and I made some good ones.
Which ones did you make in Europe?
Well, I made The Fixer. I made a movie called The Horseman. I made Impossible Object. French Connection 2.
That was in Europe?
Yeah.
Oh, of course, it was in France. What am I thinking? I just think of that as an American film.
Well,
right.
Good. But, I mean, yeah, the whole thing took place in Marseille.
Right.
And I had a pretty active career over there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to ask you about French Connection, too. The way I understand it, Gene Hackman called you and said they want to do a sequel to French Connection 1. Why did he call you?
Well, number one, he didn't.
Okay. Tell me the real story.
The real story is that I had a story and Fox had a title. 20th Century Fox had a commitment with Gene Hackman, and they had a title, French Connection 2.
Uh-huh.
They had no story. I had a very, very interesting story, which was a narcotics cop being turned into a drug addict. And I thought, and I couldn't get it made, and I thought, wait a minute, this could work for French Connection 2. And I went to 20th Century Fox, and we sold them the idea of this story. And they loved it. And then we sold it to Gene Hackman, with whom I had worked on the Gypsy Moths some years before.
Yeah, well, what happens is, you know, Hackman goes to Marseille to track down the head of this drug ring, and they end up shooting him up with heroin and getting him addicted, and then he has to go through cold turkey. Tell me about the dramatic possibilities you saw in the story that you created here of having the narcotics agent become an addict himself.
Well, I thought it was... I love irony, and I thought that was the ultimate irony. Especially to have Popeye Doyle become a drug addict, a cop that was so against this, and was so adamant that he would never do this kind of thing, and to have this happen to him, and then of course Hackman is such a wonderful actor. The idea of having Hackman go through this whole cold turkey withdrawal was something that I thought the possibilities were endless, and I think he was brilliant in those scenes, incidentally.
Film director John Frankenheimer is my guest, director of the movies The Manchurian Candidate, French Connection 2, Black Sunday, and a new film called The Fourth War. Well, some of your early work was in live television doing dramas. You did a lot of Playhouse 90s.
I did, yes. I did 153 live television shows.
Yeah, that's really a lot. Was there a lot of improvising required on your part as a director? If something would go wrong, you'd have to just kind of follow through on it.
Strangely, in the 153 shows that I did, very few things ever went wrong. We went into the shows very, very well prepared. Don't forget, we rehearsed in most of those shows for over 3 weeks. We had 4 days on camera. We had a highly, highly trained and expert camera crew. Every shot was predetermined. Every shot was thought out. Every shot had been marked in my script long before we ever got on camera. The most horrendous things that ever happened to me in live television was when I was an assistant director and not in control of my own destiny. I remember when I was an assistant director and Eva Marie Saint and Francis L. Sullivan were on this show, and they were supposed to be flying 50,000 feet above the Himalayas and be crash land and be rescued by these Chinese ski troops. We were in this set, which was about the size of a postage stamp with the two actors. And suddenly, Francis L. Sullivan, who was making his live television debut, just went up. I mean, he just couldn't remember his lines. It was supposed to be 50,000 feet above the Himalayas. And he just looked into the camera. And he said, my stop. He says, I think I'll get off. And he just got and he walked off the set. And we... we cut to the camera one, which was on the commercial announcer, and there was no sound on the commercial announcer. And you saw him talking to the agency man, and over this you heard this English accent saying, 40 years in this bloody business, and oh, I've never got up. And suddenly the sound came on over the commercial announcer, and he starts doing the Armstrong Cork commercial. I mean, it was just an unbelievable mess, at which point I was on the phone to Master Control in New York, and we were doing it from New York, and I said, look, you've got to take us off the air. There's nothing we can do now. It's just gone. Do anything. Just run a movie, anything. And they did take us off the air. That's the only time that that's ever happened. But that was as an assistant.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. My guest is film director John Frankenheimer. And one of the things you've been doing lately is some commercials, or at least one commercial that I'm familiar with, the French Bicentennial commercial.
Yeah.
And Well, there's several versions of it. I've seen short versions, and I've seen the long version. The long version is, I think, close to 3 minutes. And it's a little story on film. Describe the story.
Well, the story is basically a news correspondent who's sent over to cover the bicentennial. But just before he goes, he realizes he's going to miss his parents' 50th wedding anniversary, and he remembers a photograph taken of them when they were married in France at a little restaurant. And when he's in France, he phones his wife to fax over the picture, and he tries to find the restaurant, and indeed he does find the restaurant, and he invites the family over, and they celebrate the 50th anniversary in France at that little restaurant.
This is one of the longest commercials I've ever seen, the long version of it.
Yeah, it is. It's about 3 minutes, as you said.
What led you into doing commercials? And how long have you been doing them?
Well, I did quite a few commercials when I was living in Europe. It's quite common for movie directors to do commercials when you live in France and when you live in London. And I like doing commercials. I love doing commercials, as a matter of fact. I mean, I love the idea of having to compress time to get it into that, to tell a story in that short period of time, because that's basically that's one of the big changes in directing movies over the years, and the fact that the audiences, strangely, have become less literate in the fact that you really are basing, a lot of the audience doesn't read. But they have become more visually aware. In other words, they really, because of the MTVs, because of constant exposure to television and so forth, they understand visual images a lot better than they did 20 years ago. And you can compress time, and you can compress transitions, and you don't have to spend as much screen time trying to explain something visually as you did before. And, of course, doing commercials is one of the best things in the world to train you to condense what you're trying to do. I mean, after I did that AT&T commercial, I went back and looked at Fourth War and cut 7 minutes out of it.
Really?
Yeah.
It became clear to you what was excess in it?
Yeah. I mean, suddenly I realized I didn't need this, and this. It just became a lot tighter and a lot cleaner.
Huh. Well, do you know what your next project will be after the Fourth War?
I do. It's called Year of the Gun. It's a picture that I'm going to be doing for Ed Pressman Productions. Ed's a very successful independent producer. And we film it in Rome starting in August. It's a thriller.
Well, great. I wish you the best with your new movies, and I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
My guest has been John Frankenheimer, and his new movie, The Fourth War, will be opening on March 23rd. He also directed The Manchurian Candidate, French Connection 2, Birdman of Alcatraz, Black Sunday, and 52 Pickup, just to name a few. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, my guest will be film historian Leonard Leff. His new book, The Dame in the Kimono, is a history of Hollywood's self-censorship through the code from the 1920s to the 1960s. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. By the year 2030, many urbanites will have moved to small villages, and bicycles will have replaced cars as our primary mode of transportation. These are only two of the adjustments Lester Brown says we'll have to make to ensure the Earth's future health. Coming up, part two of our interview with the president of the World Watch Institute on the environmental future of the planet. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a reissue of Otto Klemperer conducting classical German works. And book critic John Leonard reviews Deception, Philip Roth's new novel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Moscow today, Soviet leader Gorbachev dismissed the idea of a unified Germany staying in NATO. The Soviet president made his comments during a meeting with East German Prime Minister Hans Modrow. NPR's Ann Gerrels has this report.
According to Soviet and East German spokesmen, Gorbachev and Modrow agreed that NATO membership for a united Germany would be a continuation of the Cold War. West Germany, supported by other Western powers, has proposed that a united Germany remain in NATO, though Bonn has said NATO forces would be barred from present-day East Germany. But today, Gorbachev and Modrow said the inclusion of a united Germany in NATO is unacceptable, no matter what the modifications. At an East-West meeting in Ottawa last month, Soviet officials had left the issue open, merely saying they would prefer a neutral Germany. The Soviet Foreign Ministry said the two Germanys, plus the four World War II allies, Britain, the United States, France, and the Soviet Union, would probably meet next week before East German elections to begin discussions on German reunification. I'm Ann Gerrels in Moscow.
West German Chancellor Kohl is backed away from an earlier demand for concessions by Poland on a border treaty. The Kohl government is proposing that a unified Germany sign a treaty with Poland, declaring that the right of Poles to live in secure borders will not now or in the future be questioned. Kohl has been criticized for his reluctance to state clearly that a unified Germany would not question Poland's western border. In the United States, the FAA today issued final rules for preventing metal fatigue damage in aging Boeing airplanes. The agency also proposed tough new rules for detecting corrosion in older planes. NPR's Wendy Kaufman has more.
2 years ago, the roof of an aging Aloha Airlines Boeing 737 ripped off in midair over Hawaii. The cause of the accident, which killed one and injured 64, was metal fatigue. Corrosion was also found. The new rules are designed to prevent a similar accident in the future. That's especially important as more old planes remain in service. The new fatigue rules, which take effect in 30 days, require replacement of some parts when a plane reaches a set number of flights. The rules will immediately affect 115 older U.S.-registered Boeing aircraft. The corrosion rules, which are not yet final, call for periodic inspections of Boeing jets as they age. The FAA is now finalizing fatigue rules for McDonnell Douglas aircraft. Rules for other planes will be issued by the end of the year. This is Wendy Kaufman reporting.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up over 27 points to close at 2,676.80 on volume of some 144 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. The German conductor Otto Klemperer, who died in 1973, was one of the last direct disciples of Gustav Mahler. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says Klemperer's many performances of the classical German repertoire are among this century's greatest musical legacies. Lloyd has a review of some new Klemperer reissues from Angel Records.
In 1907, when Otto Klemperer was not quite 22, he played for Gustav Mahler a piano arrangement he'd made of the scherzo of Mahler's gigantic Second Symphony, and he played it from memory. Mahler was so impressed, he wrote the young conductor a recommendation that helped launch his career, a career that took him to Berlin, Budapest, Los Angeles, and finally London. In 1951, the powerful British record producer Walter Legg who was head of EMI, the parent company of Angel Records, hired Klemperer to conduct the Philharmonia Orchestra, which Legg himself had recently founded. After years of illness, neglect, and bad luck, Klemperer became the idol of London. At the age of 67, he began his magnificent series of recordings with the Philharmonia, and later the New Philharmonia, a relationship that lasted nearly 20 years. Klemperer is still associated with the music of Mahler, and two of his greatest Mahler recordings, the Second and Ninth Symphonies, have recently been re-released on compact discs. Here's Klemperer conducting with delicate wit the very music he played for Mahler over half a century earlier. Mahler and Klemperer had a number of things in common. Both were Jewish, both became Roman Catholics. Klemperer's monumental scale and crystalline textures owes a lot to Mahler. The cliche about Klemperer is that his tempos are very slow and heavy. Though he conducts some passages faster than anyone else, his most characteristic tempos certainly are slow. But they're so rhythmically alive, there's nothing heavy about them. Their spaciousness actually allows you to hear every note. This passage from the Brahms Third Symphony has surely never had a graver beauty. In Klemperer's slow motion, even the little transitional phrases have unforgettably melodic lines of their own. Klemperer underwent more than his share of mental and physical suffering. He was chronically manic-depressive. During a rehearsal in 1933, the podium rail gave way. He fell backwards and hit his skull. Later, a brain tumor left him partially paralyzed. A broken leg put him out of commission for over a year. At 81, he broke his hip. Once he fell asleep smoking and ignited his bed. What he used to extinguish the fire turned out to be liquid camphor. It was amazing he survived. Klemperer was a large man, 6'4", and his endurance must have been phenomenal. Perhaps all this suffering gave him a special insight into works like Mahler's crushing yet sublime Ninth Symphony. Almost everything he played glowed with a spiritual flame. But Klemperer was also famous for his caustic wit, a quality perhaps inherited by his son, the character actor Werner Klemperer, who played Colonel Klink on Hogan's Heroes. At the recording session of Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony, Walter Legg questioned Klemperer's radically slow tempo for the peasant merrymaking. Klemperer told him he'd get used to it. A few minutes later, Klemperer phoned Legg in the control booth and asked, "Walter, are you used to it yet?"
Otto Klemperer conducting Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony. It's one in a series of Klemperer reissues on Angel Records. Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. This is Fresh Air. Lester Brown and the World Watch Institute have just released their report, State of the World 1990, evaluating the environmental health of the planet. Yesterday, I spoke with Lester Brown about some of the biggest environmental problems facing us today. As you might guess, things don't look so good. Today, we'll discuss what he thinks needs to be done to reverse the trend toward worldwide self-destruction. Brown says we have 40 years to reverse that trend. I asked him, why 40?
Let me first say that there are two sort of time horizons that we work with. The first is the amount of time we have in which to reverse the basic trends of environmental degradation of the planet, the deforestation, the soil erosion, the loss of plant and animal species. Those trends, we think, we have to pretty much get turned around during the current decade, during the decade of the 90s. Then the second question is, when can we expect, if we're successful, to have an environmentally sustainable global economic system in place, and to finish building, as it were, an environmentally sustainable economic system, we pick the year 2030. What we have done is essentially apply the principles of environmental sustainability to the design of an economic system. We know there are certain conditions that have to be satisfied. The question is, if we satisfy those conditions, what will the world look like? Well, we see a world, for example, that's not powered by fossil fuels because we can't continue to create an ever hotter planet, lest it eventually become uninhabitable.
Well, if you're thinking of a world without fossil fuels, what kind of alternative do you see?
Well, there are two basic alternatives to fossil fuels. One is a plutonium-based economy, where we get most of our energy from nuclear power. The second is a solar-based economy, where we get most of our energy from various solar sources, and that includes sunlight being used directly. It includes the generation of electricity from sunlight with either photovoltaic cells or solar thermal power plants. It includes wind power, hydropower, biological products of various kinds, whether it be wood, a traditional fuel, or whether it be sugarcane used to produce alcohols in Brazil, or other agricultural crops, or indeed agricultural wastes. So there are a whole range of energy sources that we need to be looking at, several which I've just mentioned.
What kind of transportation changes do you think we'd need to have an environmentally sustainable economy by 2030?
One of the things we'll be doing is using cars that are far more fuel efficient than the ones we have today. The average new car in the United States today gets something like 26 miles per gallon. There are prototypes of cars. For example, Volvo has an LCP 2000 model, as they call it, that gets nearly 90 miles per gallon. But probably the most interesting development in the transportation system is that the personal transport system of the year 2030 will be bicycle-centered rather than automobile-centered. And that That comes perhaps as a surprise to many Americans, but the interesting thing is that in the world today, there are roughly twice as many bicycles as automobiles, roughly 800 million bicycles, 400 million automobiles. Now, if you're in China, where the number of where the ratio of bicycles to automobiles is about 400 to 1, it's easy to see what a bicycle-centered transport system looks like. We expect that in many Western industrial cities, for example, that efforts will be made to create bicycle-friendly transport systems, that is, systems where there are separate bicycle lanes or streets or bicycle paths or what have you, where people feel comfortable riding a bicycle to work and for shopping and other purposes.
I should say here that you see some big changes happening in the next 40 years in terms of where people live. For instance, you see people living closer to their place of work so that they don't have to take long car rides to get there. And you also see a shift away from urban living more toward rural living.
The urbanization of the last half of the 20th century has been largely made possible by cheap liquid fuel, principally fuels derived from oil. As we move beyond the fossil fuel age, it's quite possible, indeed we think likely, that the urbanization of the last half of the 20th century will in many parts of the world be reversed, and more people will be living in smaller towns and in rural areas somewhat self-sufficient communities than is the case today.
Self-sufficient in the sense that they could grow some of their own food?
Grow some of their own food and produce much of their own energy.
I guess I'm interested in hearing how my day-to-day life might be different if I were living in your projection of a sustainable society created in the next 40 years.
Well, in looking at the changes that have to occur, for example, all scientists who look at this would agree that we have to phase out fossil fuels. And the first thing that comes to the mind of many people is, you know, oh, my God, there goes my car. Well, that may be, or at least it'll be a much more efficient car. But I am not prepared to accept the idea that the automobile-centered economic system of which we're a part represents the ultimate human social evolution. When I see the frustration of drivers, the traffic congestion in cities, the air pollution, I find that not altogether appealing, and I think we can do better. And as we begin to get serious about designing communities that are less automobile dependent, I think we'll begin to sense how pleasant a community can be if it's not completely dominated in its design by the automobile.
Well, I'll tell you, public transportation systems would have to get a whole lot safer before I ever felt comfortable giving up my car at night and taking the trains.
One of the reasons that you don't feel safe at night is because of the amount of social disintegration that's occurred in our cities and the loss of a sense of community. And one of the reasons for this is the effect of the automobile on things. People become very isolated, many people don't even know the people who live down the road or down the street from them because their automobile takes them from home to work, and there's almost no sense of community. We've lost something that I think is pretty valuable, and we don't altogether understand why.
What other personal things will I be giving up in the next 40 years?
Sustainable economy of 2030 will be a recycling economy. It will not be a throwaway economy. When you go by the supermarket checkout counter today, it's likely that you're often asked, would you rather have a paper bag or a plastic bag? That's probably not the right question. The question in the year 2030 will be, do you have your grocery bag with you? And it will be a canvas bag or some other sort of bag that you will use again and again and again.
Now, you point out in your report on the State of the World 1990 that if we are to create a sound planet, that we have to give up evaluating our health by the gross national product, that that's just not the best indicator of how we're doing. Why not, and what do you think is going to have to replace it?
Well, one of the difficulties with the gross national product is it measures only economic trends and not environmental and resource trends. For example, if a third world country decided to cut all of its forests this year and sell the wood for timber or paper pulp or whatever, there would be an enormous boom in the GNP. But if you look at the environmental conditions that result from that, you would see a country denuded of its tree cover. You would see next year enormously destructive floods, uncontrollable soil erosion, an economy that could literally be in shambles. And what we think is needed is a set of economic accounts that takes into effect the resource accounts.
If we weren't using the GNP as an indicator, what would the indicators be?
We might measure basic social indicators, health, life expectancy, and the availability of various amenities like art museums, local parks, the things that add up to a very pleasant life.
If we don't follow this kind of prescription for change in the next 40 years, what do you think is ahead?
We won't have to wait 40 years if we don't start moving on to an environmentally sustainable economic path. We are now moving into a period where environmental degradation is going to increasingly affect economic trends. We have now seen two regions of the world, namely Africa and Latin America, where per capita food production has declined in both during the 80s. The number of people who are hungry and malnourished has increased in both continents. The rate of infant mortality has increased in many countries in both of these regions. So the idea that living standards could begin to deteriorate in large areas of the world is no longer hypothetical. It's happening. And I might add, in neither Africa nor Latin America are there any actions in prospect that will reverse these trends of deterioration.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Terry, it's my pleasure.
Lester Brown is president of the World Watch Institute in Washington, D.C., and co-author of State of the World 1990. It's published by W.W. Norton. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. We're going to lead the program with more from Nicaragua on UNO, the coalition government, and their attempts to effect a peaceful transition of power there. Other stories that continue to be unsettled, potential possibility of a coup in Afghanistan, and more on West Germany and the discussions with Poland about the state of the borders and where the borders will be after Germany is united. We also have some lighter moments here, Terry. We're talking to Girl Scouts about cookies.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In several of Philip Roth's novels, the author has named his writer hero Nathan Zuckerman. The writer hero in Roth's new novel is named simply Philip. But book critic John Leonard says creating a namesake doesn't bring us any closer to understanding Roth.
There's something to be said for hearing Philip Roth speak in tongues, although not much. Deception is a novel about art and adultery, made up entirely out of conversation, a new kind of oral sex. It's all talking heads. The tongues in these heads belong to a Jewish writer named Philip in a studio in London, and Philip's married lover, a Gentile Englishwoman in a tiresome marriage of convenience, and a former student and lover of Philip's, smart but maybe crazy, and two young women from Eastern Europe, one Polish and one Czech, who've also cuddled Philip, and last, Philip's wife, who reads the notebook in which Philip's recorded these conversations and decides that he's jerking her around. He isn't really. He's jerking himself around. That's the problem. On television or in novels, whether talking heads are worth our while depends on whether they've got brains. Instead of brains, deception has accents. They're distinctive accents. Roth has a wonderful mimic ear. The Englishwoman tells Philip, "So our story isn't a love story, really. It's a cultural story. That's the one that interests you. That explains the Gentile women, doesn't it? You fall in love for the anthropology." The Czechoslovakian tells him of becoming a prostitute. "I found that my body was out of the usual. They invited me for modeling. I will tight my big breast under the clothes. I will go take voice and speech lessons just to lose my accent." Philip tells the Pole, "Anyway, I'm kissing your sentences, not you. I'm kissing your English." And when Philip says to his wife that the Englishwoman in his notebook is imaginary, she replies in a reasonable rage, "Explain it to me, if you will, then, how you happen to know all these things about English life that this Englishwoman who doesn't exist tells you in your studio while you are conducting this affair with her in your head." But Philip's wife misses the point, the same way Roth feels that his readers and reviewers miss his point. He stamps his foot. Writers can do anything they want to. Anyway, they can't help themselves. Besides that, Philip isn't Zuckerman, and Roth isn't Philip. The Philip who isn't Roth explains to the Englishwoman who may or may not be imaginary, "I write fiction and I'm told it's autobiography. I write autobiography and I'm told it's fiction. So since I'm so dim and they're so smart, let them decide what it is or it isn't." But of course he won't let us, whoever he is. The unsocialized Roth, who reads his reviewers and flies into a rage, is at it again. The same tune on the same kazoo. A bad boy playing with himself. I'm no longer the least bit interested in what really happened to him and what he only imagined. I just want him to get on with it, writing books full of felt life, in which at least the cancer is real. And lovers in London might talk about Maggie Thatcher or Salman Rushdie instead of the imaginary Phillips' imaginary novels about an imaginary Zuckerman. A world in which the choices human beings make have consequences instead of reviews. A world where, when the wounded bleed, it isn't ink.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Philip Roth's new novel, Deception. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person, with assistance from Joan Tuohy and Roberta Shurrock. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the story of how the Hollywood censors controlled on-screen sex, violence, childbirth, and divorce from the 1930s until the 1960s. Also, Michael Moriarty on his acting and his songwriting. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.